Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news at 7 o'clock. Right now, on this day, a very, very busy day in history indeed. The 1st of October is the day, in case anyone is wondering. We start in 1888. The first ever National Geographic magazine would be published on this day. In 1891, Stanford University would open its doors with Leland Stanford dedicating the Stanford University to his son. In 1894, the first Owl Club meeting in... The first Owl Club of Cape Town meeting would take place on this day. 1907, on this day, there'd be a run on the US dollar that would lead to the president of the United States, Franklin Roosevelt at the time, calling on J.P. Morgan for assistance in calming the financial crisis. Now we know why the bank's so big. In 1908, Henry Ford would introduce the Model T at a price of $825. Interestingly enough, that would be about 14,250 rand today. In 1934, on this day, Adolf Hitler would violate the Treaty of Versailles. No surprises there. In 1939, Winston Churchill would call Russia the enigma wrapped in a mystery Rather, the riddle wrapped in a mystery inside of an enigma. Very confusing there. In 1957, on this day, the United States dollar, the cash currency, the physical currency, would first see the words "In God We Trust" appear on the currency. 1959, on this day, a gentleman by the name of Yusu Du would be born on this day. For those who don't know who that is a former minister of tourism in Senegal. He was also a singer who gave us a very iconic song, 7 Seconds. You can Google that. And in 2004, on this day, the Chinese would celebrate exactly today 75 years of the Communist Party rule on this day. So big days to celebrate, lots happening in history. There's a couple of other factors we've skipped over, but we'll get to those throughout the show. You're tuned into the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb. I'm your host, Jimmy Muyaha, and on the show today, we are taking a look at Capitec numbers. They gave us their interim results for the 6 months ended August 2024. I've got a conversation with Capitec CEO Gerry Fourie around that performance and what to expect going into the rest of the year. We've got a conversation with the CEO of the SA SME Fund, that's Ketso Godan, about the 300 million rand seed fund they've launched to help startups. Then we've got a conversation with Leighton Beard around fuel price cuts in October. We haven't caught up with Leighton in quite a bit of time, and it's always good to catch up when it's regarding good news, not so much when it's regarding fuel price increases. Then we've got a conversation with Discovery around increases. They're increasing medical aid costs into 2025. We're going to figure out by how much and how that's going to affect you and I as consumers. And then because it's Tuesday, we're going to kick off October with a Property Tuesday. We're going to be taking a look at REITs, real estate investment trusts, as an asset class. We're going to look at the performance of REITs throughout the year and whether or not now's a good time to be getting in on those.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
As usual, we kick off with how the markets have been moving. It's been a really interesting day of market movements throughout today. I'm joined on the line by the founder of Herenia Capital Advisors, Pietri Redlinghuis, to take a look at the market movements and see if we can make sense of them. Good evening, Marmalade. Lovely to speak to you as always. Markets having quite an interesting day, depending on which side of the market you are sitting on. Resources, without a doubt, coming to the party.
Yeah, it's been a bit of a resource-themed week. Ironically, earlier today on the TV show is called, Trade of the Week, whatever, I caught some shorts on the resource counters, just because I think that they've probably gone a little too far too fast. You know, in the longer term time frames, yes, still very bullish on the sort of sector as a whole, as I think you and I have spoken about many times. But, you know, some of these stocks are up 15-20% in like 3 days, right? And Monday, Tuesday have kind of gone sideways. So feeling that maybe it's a little overdone, although I think the standout performers today was obviously the platinum stocks. They did really well. The diversified guys like the Anglos and the Billitons and the South 32s, these guys are looking like they're running out of a bit of momentum. But all of that is really just on the back of, a couple of things, really. But stimulus out of China, interest rate cuts, this is a big theme. Market is really jubilant on the back of this, which kind of fits the narrative that you and I spoke about some time ago as well, being that the playbook from here is at some point interest rates get cut, which has happened. Market sees that as tremendously positive, which is happening. 6 to 9 months later, the world figures out, wait a minute, this is not necessarily such good news. Generally, this leads to recession when interest rates start being cut. If you look historically, every single time that's happened. Will it happen tomorrow? Probably not. But will it happen within the next sort of 9 months? Yeah, my odds are pretty good, yes.
I love this. No matter how bullish Pietri has been over the last couple of weeks, every single time I've spoken to him, he's been the one analyst who's always come out to say the recession is coming. But before we get to that, Pietri, the Chinese markets would have been closed today, National China Day, Hong Kong markets closed as well. But off the back of that stimulus, as you mentioned yesterday, they ran hard. The Shanghai Composite up 8% off of yesterday's movements. Is that kind of momentum something that will filter through into, I mean, we saw it filter through into SA markets. Is that something that's going to continue to filter through into at least emerging markets?
I don't know. So we've got to keep in mind that they're now going to essentially close for the next week. So we are rudderless, I suppose, when it comes to taking a lead from China. However, I think that there's a different catalyst in the market that cropped up just a bit sort of closer to the end of the day. Being that Iran isn't so pleased with Israel. So we were kind of putting a poll together in our client community, asking clients if they believe that, Iran is going to strike Israel tonight or, you know, at some point in the next week or so. And if that is the case, what do we do to position ourselves accordingly? So we've seen oil price up something like 3.75% last time I was at my desk, which was about an hour ago, and the U.S. market down about 1%. So I think that is kind of throwing a bit of cold water on markets at the moment as that risk-off sentiment comes through. You know, it's a weird day because in the morning we saw relatively bearish news for oil, increased production from OPEC nations, one of the smaller countries coming back online and, peace essentially reigning and oil production returning to normal. And then later in the day we have this, well, we've got basically a declaration of war. Uncertain terms or whatever, it's really looking like it's going to escalate in the Middle East. And that drives a lot of fear back into the market and it drives the oil price up. So I think that we probably see oil prices rise and, oil stocks, along with them. But that might not necessarily be good for equities as people kind of scramble to cover risk.
You say that might not be good for equities, and I was going to get to that conversation now to say a little earlier on, before you and I jumped on this call, the NASDAQ was down more than 2%. Now it's down probably about 1.7%. It's still down significantly. Is that the fear sort of creeping into the market to say if we are to expect some form of escalation in tensions in the Middle East, then equity markets will not do so well?
Well, I think that's part of it. I think there's a dual situation happening. You and I, we have spoken in the past about sort of the shift from west to east, right? Mm. So I think that our view is essentially that we would rather back Chinese tech over U.S. tech. Not that U.S. tech companies aren't good. It's just that they're not worth 50 times earnings, right? So they're just super overvalued. So we might see a shift from overvalued stocks into undervalued stocks, aka go South Africa. I mean, if you compare us to the US over the last 10 years, we can double and we still wouldn't have caught up, right? So I think that we probably see a shift out of the really good performing hyper return stocks like the tech stocks into safer stuff. So into, oil-backed plays, for example, or into gold, or into commodities that are relatively no doubt going to do well on the back of China's stimulus. So I think that shift is beginning to happen potentially. And then I think combine that with a little bit of, call it overnight risk, if you will, or, risk of escalation of tensions and potential fallout. We don't know what an escalation of a war situation in the Middle East kind of leads to. So that uncertainty says, well, these stocks have done really well. Maybe they're overvalued. It's time to take the money.
Pietri, does that bode well for the gold price, which has in its own right been running as well?
I think so. Our original view, and I'll be quite frank, was that gold would reach the top of the channel and then probably turn down back lower. It's reached the top of the channel. It broke through the top of the channel and it hasn't stopped going up. So I got that one wrong, I think. So yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think any kind of escalation of tension and fear that comes into the market, negative equity prices, generally people tend to move to safe havens. So gold should do relatively well. And I think there's a massive catch-up play in the platinum space as well, but that's, you know, on the back of a different catalyst. But yeah, I think precious metals are in a good space to probably continue to remain robust. And that's about as you know, as broad as I can answer that.
If they're going to remain robust, how well does that position South Africa and South African mining stocks? I mean, we saw the run on resource counters today, but it does always take a while for the actual price movement from the commodity side to translate into an equal or a similar movement in our commodity counters.
Yeah, well, look, I think there's a finance minister somewhere in Africa licking his lips at the prospect of higher tax income, right? So it will definitely bode very well for our local businesses, local mining companies. And we know that the miners are generally very highly geared to movements in the underlying commodities. So, you know, for every kind of $10 the gold price goes up, the gold miners are going to go up 10%, right? Well, not quite, but you get the idea. So I think that our mining businesses are relatively well positioned. If we get sustained higher, you know, commodity prices, precious metals prices, the guys are going to be printing profit like crazy. Provided that we can keep the labor situation, you know, everybody happy and everybody working and there's no major strikes or power outages or anything like that, I think we're in a very good place, yes.
So good time to be investing in SA counters, equally a good time to be looking at taking some risk off the table. I think we'll leave it at that. Pietri, thanks as always for the time and for the insights. That was Pietri Riedlinghuis, who is the founder at Herenia Capital Advisors, joining us to reflect on the market movements and what could potentially be driving investor sentiment.
The more time you give yourself to save for retirement, the bigger the reward at the end. Don't waste your head start. Start investing now and choose the future you deserve. 91, investing for a world of change. 91 is an authorized FSP.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
To kick us off this morning, we got a six-month update from Capitec. They gave us an update on their performance for the 6 months ended 31 August 2024. I have the privilege of catching up with the company's CEO, Harry Fourie, to take a look at the performance of the bank over the last 6 months. Good evening, Harry. Lovely to speak to you as always. Having a look at the numbers, some of the headline features, I mean, obviously operating profits up 41%, headline earnings up 36%, equity up 17%. Very little, if anything, to complain about.
Yeah, good evening, listeners. Yeah, I think if we look at our results, very strong results. I think 36% is actually a testimony of decisions that we've taken 5 years ago, where we've decided to heavily invest in tech and data and diversify the income streams. And you can see it. We've got now business banking, we've got insurance, we've got value-added services, we've got Capitec Connect. So, yeah, we're very happy with the way our strategy has played off in the last 5 years.
Speaking of that five-year period, clients now sitting north of 23 million, whereas around 2019, we're probably around the 12 million rand mark, if I remember correctly. That's clearly a massive growth from a bank's perspective, but for any business, what's been the secret sauce?
You know, if I look at Capitec Foundations or fundamentals, it's all about simplicity and transparency to put the client in control. You know, our fundamentals is affordability, accessibility, simplicity, and service. And we've built the brand on it that people understand that we are very focused on affordability. We're very focused on personal service. And I think that has helped us going through this period. So it's just sticking to those fundamentals.
Harry, we caught up in April and we were looking at just kind of the uncertainty that sat within heading into an election, all of the challenges we'd gone through in the last couple of years and just needing a bit of stability from an economic standpoint. A couple of months later, it's a completely different picture. And I want to get your thoughts on that. I mean, I don't think anyone kind of anticipated how well this could have turned out.
Yeah, I've just spoken to somebody else now, and I said, you know, at the beginning of the year, we were load shedding and we're all worried about it. Now we're saying, where's the load shedding? And then, you know, before the elections, everyone was worried, where will it end? And I don't think we could have wished for a more positive outcome. And if you're looking at what's happening in the world, just positive signs coming through. Yes, there's some elections that still need to come. But even, you know, look at China. It's a big partner of South Africa. That has introduced a big stimulus package. So things are definitely looking better. I think what is important for us is to focus. And for me, the focus must be that we all talk growth. How do we grow South Africa that we can get a GDP of 5, 6%? And I really believe it's achievable if all the ministers and everyone focus on one thing and we grow the economy and we unlock the potential in South Africa.
Speaking of things that are achievable, something else we caught up on was around the impairments and the credit book that we looked at in April. And I'm looking at the numbers now and my calculations might be a little bit off, but it looks as though there's about R1 billion in improvements to impairments. Tell me what happened here.
Yeah, I remember our impairments was at 11%. Credit loss ratio was 11% in August last year. It dropped to 9.1% in February and now it's at 8.3%. So what we've done is to tighten our credit policy to bring it within our risk appetite. We've said that to the market that we're unhappy with it. And I think it's a testimony to management. You know, we said we will correct it and we have corrected it. And now it's how do you grow the credit side? Because talking about a positive economy, the one thing when the economy is tight is you're very tight on credit. And when the economy is positive, you need to look at the opportunities. And we'll definitely look at the opportunities to open up on the credit space.
Mkhari, you've made some really brave business decisions from a business point of view, and I want to look at two of those decisions. I want to look at the bumper dividend or interim dividend of R20.80 per share that we've declared this time around, but I also want to look at the banking division of the business. Mercantile was bought out a couple of years ago, and I find it very interesting, of all of the kind of business offerings that are out there in the banking space, you're pricing your business banking at the same price as your retail banking. That's a brave decision.
Yeah, you know, it's one of those things. I don't understand why a person with a high income must pay a different rate to a person with a low income rate. Why must a person in business banking pay differently to a person in retail banking? If you do a transaction, it costs you, let's say, 80 cents and then charge the client a small profit margin, make it 20 cents, and that's R1. And I'm just using it as an example. But the cost for us, if we do a business bank transaction or a retail bank transaction, is exactly the same. There's no reason why you must pay, let's say, R5 for business and R1 for retail. So that's why we've said that all clients, all businesses are is exactly the same. It's the same systems, the same processes. And that's why we've made the pricing exactly the same, so that there's no confusion between retail and business banking. Clients pay exactly the same and it's seen as exactly the same.
Mkhari, I want to look at the next 6 months. Obviously, we're kind of going into a much better period globally, but also locally. And I want to look at where the focus sits for Capitec. You've got a couple of competitors coming into the space, introduction of new banks. We're seeing this kind of push and pull in the whole physical banking versus digital banking morphing world. I want to kind of get a sense of where you're looking at for areas of growth. I know that the Averfin business is kind of still your offshore exposure for the time being, and I'm guessing Capitec going offshore is in the long-term pipeline, but what does the next kind of 6 to 18 months look like for you? What are you focusing on?
Yeah, I think your time period of 6 is very short. You need to look actually 2 to 3 to 5 years from now. We're going into our strat sessions now, and we tend to look 5 to 10 years from now to make certain we make the right calls. But, you know, business banking has just been a new system, new processes. So it's just out of the foundations. The same with insurance. We believe there's a lot of opportunities in VAS or strategic initiatives. And then to optimize the 24 million clients. And then you're sitting with Averfin. We're definitely going to look at how do you do different funding for Averfin? How do you decrease prices? How do you increase the term? So there's plenty for us to go out and do. So we're very optimistic.
Are the global conditions kind of stable enough to be able to look out 5 years? I mean, if we look back 5 years, it was a very, very different picture and nobody would have predicted COVID happening. I'm guessing for the next 5 years, again, we're hoping for smooth waters?
Yeah, I think the biggest question is what is going to happen in the Middle East? That's very uncertain at this stage. Then you're sitting with an American election. It's going to be interesting to watch what happens. But I think if I look at looking at the next 2 to 3 years, it's much better than what it looked like when COVID was taking place. So I think there's opportunities to use in this area.
Do any of those opportunities kind of involve possibly stepping out into new areas? I mean, I know the business banking move was quite a big one as well. The Avafin move was quite a big one. Are there any other untapped areas where Capitec is sitting thinking, maybe we could venture into this? Because it's very clear that from a consumer point of view, having north of 20 million clients, north of a third of the population of the country, that's kind of bedded down as a market segment.
Yeah, we're not a company that looks for acquisitions. Mercantile was the exception, and Avafin, but it was purely easier to buy them than to build them. We've actually grown internally. That's our motto. So we rather look at making certain that we've got focus and we've got a 30-40% market share in a particular product range than to have many other products. So nothing specific that stands out that we haven't looked at. I think it's how do you grow Connect, how do you grow VAS, how do you grow business banking? All these areas has got plenty of potential.
Plenty of potential. It does still exist, and the world is looking positive. Thank you so much for the time and for the insights. That was Gerry Fourie, who is the CEO at Capitec, on their 6 months results for the 6 months ended August.
And in your business news, Reserve Bank Governor, what's his name, has repeatedly said this and that, and policymakers are expecting rates to go up or down. With inflation somewhere between 0 and 100%, interest rate relief may come sooner or later. Who knows, really? The whatchamacallit slid into undefined territory based on the Duhigi being so-so, and the markets were hard to describe. Despite initial doubts, the outcome was a mixed bag. The rand was meh based on the US consumer prices, but sentiment towards the currency could be, you know, whatever.
You can't base a decision on imprecision. Ask your financial advisor about a guaranteed annuity from Momentum Wealth. Personalized certainty.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Anyone who knows me knows I enjoy taking a look at companies and businesses that are doing more to enhance the communities around them. And we're taking a look at a very interesting initiative from the SASME Fund. They've announced that they are going live with a 300 million rand SME fund that is aimed specifically at targeting early stage capital for startups. I'm joined on the line by the CEO of the SASME Fund, that is Ketso Godan, to take a look at this and try and make sense of it. Ketso, good evening. Thanks so much for taking the time. Tell us about the 300 million rand fund. Tell us about the aim of the fund and why the fund's been launched.
So the SASME fund was created, you know, 5 or 6 years ago by the CEO initiative. It's chaired by Adrian Gore. And over the last 5 years, we've been championing the growth of the venture capital industry. We've now allocated almost 2 billion rands to build this new asset class and persuade pension funds and other institutional investors that this is a attractive area in which to invest their money. But one of the gaps in the ecosystem, the venture capital ecosystem, is that people come up with clever ideas, but there's not enough risk capital to back them for that very early stage before it's a proven product or a proven set of customers. Then there's a lot more money available. You know, once it's been proven, money becomes more readily available. But it's that initial phase, and it's typically somewhere between 1 and 10 million rand that these very smart people that come up with clever ideas need to build a business. And so this fund is aimed specifically at supporting early-stage businesses. We've done it in partnership with the Department of Science and Innovation, the Government's Technology Innovation Agency, and E-Squared, which is part of the Alan Gray family of entities. And we are the coordinator of the fund. We're going to be allocating the capital to about five different groups of funds to invest into these startup businesses. So we think, you know, this money will probably support 50 startups, and at least 10 or 15 of them are going to go on to become successful businesses.
Ketso, when we look at the sectors, you touched on the fact that there's about five kind of companies that are going to be administering the funds as well on your behalf, but that there are specific sectors that you are looking at. Tell us about the sectors and why those sectors are so important as part of our ecosystem.
So, you know, one of the things that's really interesting is that venture capital in, say, America, where it's big, you know, typically it's trying to make life a little bit more interesting or a little bit more efficient or a little bit cheaper. Whereas what we find in Africa and South Africa is that venture capital startup businesses are typically trying to solve a problem. And that's why it's even more exciting for us, because these are people who are trying to improve the quality of life of ordinary South Africans. So we want to be focused on the financial sector. Typically, it's called fintech. And most of the work being done by fintech startups is to try and improve financial inclusion, particularly of those people that are excluded from the banking sector or from their ability to get loans or, you know, do things that people with bank accounts can do. And the second sector we're very excited about supporting is edtech. You know, South Africa has a huge education challenge. The more we can do to improve the quality of education and online education and introduce new technologies that allow teachers and students to learn stuff, the better. We're also going to be doing stuff in ag tech, particularly with climate change coming up. You know, energy is expensive, water is scarce. And these are typically startup companies that are trying to optimize the use of those things, you know, doing hydroponics or coming up with clever greenhouse designs. So ag tech is going to be a big thing. And clearly, one of the other really important areas that we've done well in as a country is in health. And so we're looking at, you know, telemedicine, we're looking at health devices, we're looking at the ability to provide cheaper services, particularly for primary health care. So those are the kinds of startups we'll be backing, and we're going to be working alongside things like the University Technology Fund, which is a fund we helped create 5 years ago that works with universities to help them commercialize the clever ideas that they come up with at the universities.
Getso, I want to take a look at the SME Fund and the work that you do beyond just this particular fund that is being launched or that has recently been launched. The importance of financing businesses at the right stage, but also financing kind of the right types of businesses. Take me through just how that whole ecosystem works. And in the South African context, as you said, a lot of South African businesses or a lot of African entrepreneurs are building solutions to problems that exist. How much more innovation is needed so that the solutions transcend just solving the problem, but actually creating new sectors?
Yeah, and I think that's why we're excited about venture capital, because the innovation will give rise to new industries, new entities producing things that didn't exist before. But to answer your primary question, we've been doing both debt lending to very small businesses via intermediaries and then doing venture capital. On the debt side, I just want to give you one example, which we think is life-changing for South Africans. We fund a organization called Indlu Living. They work with property owners in a township and build backroom housing, bricks and mortar, proper backroom housing. And it's a 5-year mortgage. In year 6, the property owner starts getting most of the income once the debt has been paid off. And this creates an asset. It allows for intergenerational wealth to be created. It allows for an additional income to be generated. And we've been so excited about working with these guys because it's such a clever idea. And they've got a lot of tech behind their sort of business that helps design the rooms efficiently, collect the money efficiently. It's like an Airbnb for township rooms. And, you know, they now have a book of about maybe 200 million. When we first interacted with them, they were probably at about 25 million. We lent them 50 million. And people have since then supported that activity. So we also lend to spaza shops. Spaza shops, you know, are a really important part of the ecosystem in the township. Our little bit of money helps them go and buy a larger amount of goods at a lower price once a month. And that changes, you know, the economics of their business. The revenue goes up. They can make more savings. And, you know, many of them are now opening second spaza shops or starting new businesses. I've seen many spaza shop owners buy an Uber now. So, you know, I think on the debt side, we can be very localized, very small, and help these kinds of businesses. On the venture side, we are, you know, helping people that have got technology solutions for or ideas that could lead to new businesses. One of the most exciting things we're doing at the moment is supporting a business called CubeSpace. is a business that comes out of Stellenbosch University and makes micro satellites. And, you know, South Africa, you wouldn't have thought, but we have a competitive advantage in some of the space technologies. And this is a business that, you know, one day will be worth hundreds of millions of dollars.
Ketso, I want to get your thoughts on the regulatory landscape. We know that there's no shortage of great ideas and great minds in the South African space, but sometimes the challenge comes that the regulatory landscape isn't necessarily conducive towards startups. How are you seeing this, and what are your thoughts around this from a funding perspective and from a support perspective?
So, you know, in most of the world, including some of our African neighbors, they pass a law which is called the Startup Act. And what it does is facilitates, you know, easy passage from a regulatory point of view for a startup. They're not burdened by all of the regulations that big businesses are. So, you know, it just makes their lives a little bit easier. The limited amount of capital can go a longer way. You know, they're not going to be breaking the rules. They're just, you know, they're going to be trying to operate in the most efficient way possible. And in South Africa, you know, we have a campaign for a Startup Act. It's getting a bit of traction, and, you know, we are interacting with government. And, you know, one can hope that the seventh administration will look upon this campaign more favorably and maybe pass a law which allows small businesses not to be encumbered by all the bureaucratic requirements of a typical government.
The red tape must be moved out of the way. It's important for SMEs to grow. We certainly need more ideas and more thinking like this. I think this is a good starting point and certainly a good place to go to from here. We'll see how the story unfolds. We'll see how the fund unfolds. Thank you for setting it up, and thank you for the time and for the insights. That's Ketso Kordaan, who is the SA SME Fund CEO, on the latest 300 million rand fund they've set up to assist small businesses.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It's been 1 month since the implementation of the new two-pot system, and billions have flowed out of retirement funds as investors withdraw from their savings component. Join the SAFM Market Update tomorrow evening at 6:45 as Alan Gray's head of retail, Tamarin Lamb, discusses the potential impact of the new two-pot era on South Africa's retirement outcomes and explains how investors can improve their odds of achieving a comfortable retirement. Brought to you by Alan Gray, 50 years of long-term investing. Alan Gray is an authorized financial services provider.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
There's a lot happening in the world, and when we typically think about these things, we often forget to take stock of some of the small victories. We're going to be doing just that now. We're going to be looking at fuel price cuts coming in October. I'm joined on the line, as always, by the Automobile Association spokesperson, Leighton Beard, to take a look at this. Good evening, Leighton. Lovely to speak to you again. Please tell me you have good news. All right, I think we're still trying to get Leighton on the line there. In the meantime, what we will be taking a look at is... Oh, we've got Leighton. Okay, there we go. We've gotten hold of him. Good evening, Leighton. Lovely to speak to you as always. Good news for us today?
Yeah, sorry about that, Jimmy. My phone's telling me it's an unstable network. I think a lot of unstable things happening at the moment. One of the more stable things is obviously the good news in the fuel price. Seeing a lot of decreases, you know, the fifth consecutive decrease this year, bringing the fuel price in line to what it was, you know, as far back as 2022. So, yeah, I mean, very, very good news for consumers, and I think something that we can be really happy about.
When we look at the developments around the world, Leighton, obviously the oil price is such a big factor in the fuel price, given how much fuel we import as a net importer in South Africa.
Yeah.
The growing tensions in the Middle East, we're seeing the fuel price for the moment holding steady below $75. At what point do we start to get concerned around fuel price increases based on the oil price? Is $80 kind of an easy number here?
No, I think where we are is pretty good at the moment. I mean, we've seen increased output, lower demand, which is obviously very good. The Middle East issue, I think, is always going to be something hanging like a Damocles sword over us, and to what extent that's going to create problems down the line, I think, remains to be seen. But certainly, priced where it is at the moment, I think it's pretty well priced. Even the numbers that came through today were very positive. So I think we're in for a good ride. It's just one of those things where you have to wait and see how it plays out. Obviously, tensions in the world and geopolitical developments are going to impact on that fuel price. I think we're going to have to wait and see to what extent they actually do have an impact, Jimmy.
Leighton, I want to take a look at the SANPC, the South African National Petroleum Company, that's been newly formed now with the Central Energy Fund and PetroSA and all of that. Part of the conversations around some of these institutions was something like PetroSA buying up the refinery from Total and BP a little while ago. This new formation of the SANPC, what does this kind of do for the South African landscape, understanding that we could realistically go back to having refineries and maybe importing less? Or am I dreaming too far along?
Yeah, I think that is something that's on the horizon, and I think what we'd be looking at is timeframes and exactly how that's going to play. These things could take, years to actually come to fruition. There's a lot of work that needs to happen to get them up to speed in terms of the processing capability. And as you rightfully say, the bulk of the fuel that we use in South Africa is imported. If there's going to be a measure that's going to produce it locally that we can actually get it cheaper, that's going to make a huge difference. It's one of those questions I struggle to answer because, again, we don't know how long this is all going to take.
Leighton, what are the fuel price cuts that are coming into effect now in October? And do we have a bearing on kind of what the Central Energy Fund might be thinking around November cuts, or even I think December is a bit too far out to look at this stage?
Yeah. Look, I think November's also a bit too far out, given the fact that we've seen the rand was at a really good place, over the weekend. At the weekend, it was around about 17.10 to the US dollar. It slipped a little bit today. We're back at around 17.40. So that gives you an idea of the volatility just with the currency, and it plays a big factor. At the moment, we're looking at around 1 rand 14 for 93, around 1 rand 6 for 95, thereabouts for diesel as well. So big cuts. And when you consider that, we've had big cuts over the last 5 months, totaling, in excess of 4 rand. It's really good news. Is this going to hold? Like I said to you earlier, the numbers that came through today indicated a decrease going into November as well. But it's the first of the month. So, we've got a long way to go before the end, and a lot can happen. And we do know that tensions are ratcheting up in the Middle East. And again, that could play a pivotal role in the fuel pricing and the oil pricing, and that could have a major impact locally. So it's again a question of let's see how that plays out. And, I sound like a broken record, Jimmy, but it remains to be seen. And that's unfortunately the way that we're going to have to look at it. For the moment, though, I think we must just be very happy that we are experiencing really good pricing at the moment. And I think that's obviously very welcome news for everybody.
Absolutely. We take the wins as they come and as we can get them. We'll have to, obviously, as Leighton has alluded to, wait and see how the rest of the month shapes up before we know what happens next. But we'll leave it at that for now. Leighton, thanks as always for the time and for the insights and for giving us some good news. Leighton Beard, spokesperson of the Automobile Association, on the fuel price cuts that are coming into effect this week. Remember them and wait for them so that you can enjoy a little bit of relief.
Unleash your workforce's potential with Regent Business School, proud BBBEE Level 1 provider. Elevate your team's capabilities through crafting a future-ready workforce with top-tier accredited qualifications. Immerse your company in a culture of ongoing learning, paving the way to success. And what sets us apart? Regent's custom business programs are tailored seamlessly to your company's requirements. Visit regent.ac.za. Regent Business School. Be the future.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Some consumers that might not be feeling so much relief come at 2025 are those that have Discovery Medical Aid schemes. The Medical Aid scheme has announced that there will be some increases to medical aid pricing. Joined on the line by Chief Commercial Officer from Discovery Health, Dion Kotzer, to take a look at these developments. Good evening, Dion. Thanks so much for taking the time. Obviously, no one wants these increases to happen, but I'm guessing you're going to tell me they're quite necessary.
Jimmy, yes, they are. The medical scheme obviously uses the contributions of members that they pay into the medical scheme to fund their claims for healthcare services. And effectively, what we do is to increase those contributions year on year to ensure that we can continue to pay the claims in the coming year. And those increases are then informed by what we're seeing in terms of the trend in the increases in claims year on year.
Dion, when we look at some of the increases, I mean, I'm just looking at in everything from the executive plan right down to the basic essential care plans. All plans are increasing by at least 7%, between 7 and 10%. At the same time, it can be argued that inflation was around 6.4% for 2024. The increases being a little higher than inflationary, how do you respond to that from a business's perspective?
So Jimmy, there's actually two reasons why you see the claims increase by more than the consumer price inflation. So the consumer price inflation is effectively the increase that we pass on to providers of healthcare services in terms of the tariffs. Think about it as like the unit price of a healthcare service, the cost of visiting a GP, the cost of getting medicine from the pharmacy, cost of spending a day in a general ward in the hospital. Those prices typically go up by around CPI. Over and above that, the scheme also has to fund the increase in claims for healthcare services. So apart from the fact that the unit price of healthcare services increase, the members of the medical scheme claim for more healthcare services year on year. There's two things that cause that. The one is members are getting older and sicker over time. On average, we have existing members that age, and then we have younger members joining. So on average, the scheme ages by, call it, about 6 months every year, the average age of the scheme's membership. But that aging effectively leads to a higher number of claims for healthcare services, which has to be factored in. And then the last factor is then that over and above the increases in the unit price of healthcare, there are certain new medical technologies. These could be new procedures, new facilities, or even new treatments for some of the dreaded diseases like cancer that replace existing treatment, but at a higher cost. And that higher cost effectively also is captured in those claims increases. So you've got CPI as a base. It's a completely reasonable expectation for claims to go up by that much. But the medical scheme has to contend with this, with these increases over and above that as a result of an aging population and new and more expensive technology.
Mm. Dion, while this is not necessarily what consumers want to happen, it is unfortunately part of the cycle of business and the cycle of offering these sorts of services. What's interesting is you've been able to keep the key care increases not only low, in some cases you've actually had decreases in price. And I know the key care product, if I remember correctly, is the product that mainly is focused towards elderly citizens within South Africa. And that's quite important to be able to say that even though people are getting older, their medical costs at a certain age should not be impacting their lifestyles.
Yes, correct. Look, I mean, a large part of the changes that we've announced next year is around sort of the sustainability of the medical scheme and the affordability of the contributions. So as you mentioned on key care, and in particular the key care start plans, we adjusted the income bands. On key care start, you pay a contribution according to the income that you earn, and we adjusted those income bands. And as you correctly say, for some members, they actually have a decrease in their contributions as a result of that change. We've also introduced a completely new plan into the range aimed at young professionals, those that are starting out their working life, focused on their needs, because they're kind of quite a lengthy process around the research of healthcare needs and wants of the of Generation Z, and building a plan around their needs, as well as kind of keeping it quite affordable. But at the same time, it's kind of like sustaining benefits through increasing the contributions. We've also added benefits to all plans. So from next year, members have access to what we call a personal health fund, That personal health fund is effectively the members in control of that benefit. We give the member actions that they need to complete. These actions are good for their health. It's like going to the doctor, having a colonoscopy done, seeing your dentist, doing what you're supposed to be doing to maintain your health. And in return for that, members then earn a benefit, which we call the personal health fund. And that's available on all the plans of the medical scheme from next year.
Dion, what are your thoughts around where we stand at the moment with the National Health Insurance Bill? Obviously, this is still very much in the works, and we've kind of spoken about some of the permutations that could play out now that we know that it's been signed into law. Where do we kind of land from a medical aid scheme point of view around the servicing, the provision of services, and just how it's going to impact business?
To me, I think signing the NHI bill into law now with the NHI Act effectively sets it on a pathway of implementation. So you're now in the world where the Department of Health has to implement what's in the Act. And there's quite a bit to do there. There's a couple of acts that needs to change in order, in particular around the financing of NHI to enable that. There's also committees and forums that needs to be formed for the management of the NHI. And then healthcare providers need to be contracted into the NHI. That implementation is not a small task. So it's quite a long roadmap in terms of that implementation. The NHI Act, as it is written, provides for medical schemes providing services that the NHI does not provide. So while the NHI is in this phase of implementation, there's no reason for members to think that they don't need their medical aid anymore because NHI is there. There's certainly still a need for medical schemes as the NHI is implemented. And of course, as is reported in the background, there's a lot of work that's happening between business as well as the Department of Health and Treasury in terms of understanding what's the optimal implementation roadmap for national health insurance to cater for the diverse needs of healthcare in South Africa. But I think the important thing is in the long term, if we get to a point where everybody in South Africa has access to great quality healthcare, that's the best outcome. I think it's just the roadmap that we need to get there is still kind of being defined and debated.
Quality healthcare for all, that's what we all strive for. We'll leave it at that, Dion. Thanks so much for the time, for the insights. Dion Kotzer, Chief Commercial Officer at Discovery Health, on the latest round of medical aid increases that Discovery will be implementing next year.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It's another Tuesday, and to kick off the month of October, we're kicking things off with Property Tuesday. We'll take a look at Agri Tuesday next week. This week, we're looking at Property Tuesday, and we're taking a look at the real estate investment trusts in South Africa. REITs in South Africa are back in focus. They are an attractive investment destination for some investors at this stage, and we're looking at why. I'm joined on the line by John Jack, who's the CEO of Galetti Corporate Real Estate, to take a look at this. Good evening, John, thanks so much for taking the time. Certainly a very interesting time for REITs, understanding that a couple of months ago, prior to the elections, property may not have been the most attractive investment class, but now it certainly is.
Yeah, an interesting one. And I think it's really a triangulation of a few things. First of all, you know, if you look back to the early 2000s, where we had this massive growth in the sector, it was really because you saw GDP growth coming through. So that's one of the important indicators. And then the other thing is sort of a declining interest rate. Obviously, post-COVID, we had all of the hikes come through, and now we're starting to see just those first few declines come through, or reductions at least. And that really sort of helps the REITs. You know, when their cost of borrowing goes down, of course, they're more distributable income. And so these two things together, and look, there are a number of other factors, business confidence, et cetera, electricity supply. There are a couple of things starting to come together, those green flags, if you want to call it that. And really that comes through nicely in a sector which has been largely depressed.
John, we were catching up and chatting about how the property space for all intents and purposes, especially when compared to other sectors, is more of a slow burn. And we haven't really seen, coming out of the pandemic, a significant move in terms of property companies or in terms of investors moving into properties. But we are still seeing the performance of REITs looking a lot better than it was this time last year.
Yeah. Listen, I mean, there was significant vacancies during that period. So post sort of 2020, we had companies that sort of right-sized themselves. So they'd look to optimize. And when you look to optimize, you really take a deep dive into that company. Maybe there's some cash flow distress and you say, who is actually required here? What are our subscriptions required? What services are required in this business? And so you really rationalize as much as possible. And as a result of those lower headcounts, obviously you then need less space, which then leads to a net vacancy in the market. The industry that wasn't affected as much was logistics. Logistics has been in high demand the whole way through, but it was really the offices that got hammered. And what we've seen now with a return to office, as well as a bit of growth, you've seen that take up in the offices. And so, you know, those businesses are starting to grow and so less and less vacancy. Certainly in Cape Town and Natal, the call centers are really dominating and requiring a lot of space there. And so there's hardly any vacancy here. It's just Joburg, I think, that's lagging behind.
John, part of the big attractiveness in REITs is the fact that the distributable income that translates into dividends for shareholders is always such an attractive amount. But as you alluded to, it relies on the fact that these companies or these REITs themselves are able to maintain very low vacancy levels and able to maintain high distributable incomes. When we look at the current state of the property space, are we seeing kind of that shift back towards what would be considered normal for a REIT?
Yes. And I think it's on top of those two things. So low vacancy levels, but then also, you know, your cost of servicing your debt, if that starts to come down, that's a green flag. On top of that, if you start to look at your overall expense ratio, your total expense ratio in that business, the cost of diesel, you know, landlords weren't recovering all of the diesel costs that were going in, you know, obviously to cover the lack of supply. Now we have a more than enough supply of electricity, and so they don't need to fork out for this additional diesel. That was just a random additional cost that was in. So it was a number of things piled up. But when you're asking about the actual vacancy factors in these REITs, they're actually performing really well. You know, certainly in the P-grade office sector, it's better than it was pre-COVID. So it's really that sort of A, B office sector, and predominantly, again, in Johannesburg, that the guys are taking pain. But when you look at the coastal regions, not at all. So that's why a business like Spear REIT would benefit, because they're a Western Cape only focused fund.
John, when we look at these REITs and these funds, how are they stacking up compared to perhaps some of the global peers or even some of the continental peers? I know South Africa has got quite a resilient market across many sectors. How are the property companies stacking up?
So South Africa has actually been outperforming the global markets. So a lot of interest in what we're doing here. I mean, a total return of just sort of 30% year to date, outperforming bonds and equities. That's in South African context. But globally, of course, you need to take into account your Forex and your movement in Forex and your inflation rates there and your interest rates there. So it's quite a different comparison. So when I say to you, well, the returns in the global market have been sort of 7%, well, when you look at 7% versus 30% on nominal terms, jeepers, 30% is far better, you know. But then you've got to look at our exchange rate. But now we've had a double whammy with our exchange rate strengthening. So, you know, it's an interesting market to kind of contextualize. And really, we are so small. We are so small compared to the larger capital markets in the UK and US.
John, when we look at the growth prospects of the REIT space and we look at what investors could potentially be in for, where do some of the green shoots lie? What kind of REITs exposure are we seeing? I mean, some of the REITs that we know so well in the South African space have got offshore portfolio exposures as well. Mm. And that becomes a factor as well from an investor point of view to say, as you said, some of them are solely focused in one region, like Spear, for example, but others are focused globally. How do you then pick and choose what kind of REIT would be the best to look at this time?
Sure. So obviously a lot of research goes into this, and the guys who do this best are both Investec. They've got a great analyst team there. And then on top of that, Sesfikile Capital, named Tilly and Mohamed Kalla and these guys, they really, really dig into these funds and put out excellent reports based on that. So that's where I'd start. I'd look at Investec's reports. I'd look at Sesfikile's reports on the property sector and the REITs specifically. And then, you know, you've got to decide, do you want Euro exposure? Are you looking at the Aussie exposure, you're looking at the US, and then so you're actually looking at these countries fundamentally to say, do I want US, do I want Euro, do I want Aussie dollar, you know, do I want some kind of hedge? So it becomes quite calculated, but I would leave that type of thing to the experts. We're good at the South African markets. We understand what's happening here. We understand the dynamics here. And if you want to start exposing yourself globally, then you really need to understand what's happening. Because if you look at the rand strengthening, I mean, it's gone from, I mean, I think we were on sort of 19 to the dollar. Now we sort of down to 17. So, I mean, 20 to the dollar. Now we're down to 17. I mean, that is a significant strengthening. Now imagine you put all of your capital into a dollar-based fund. What happens there? Even if that fund is growing, you're taking a discount based on the rand strengthening. Now, who knew that was going to happen? So it's very complicated.
John, are there any areas where you'd probably want to stay away from the property space or the property market? Any areas that stand out to you that might have other issues? I mean, at some point, South Africa was an area like that when we still had load shedding problems, which I won't speak too loudly of because we're afraid they might come back. But are there any areas where you look at the landscape and say this might not be the best performing area for property?
Listen, it's not that it's not performing, but I would say logistics has really run hot for a couple of years now. So it's right. There just doesn't seem to be a lot of growth there. First of all, you've had the building costs go up significantly. So just the cost of steel has gone up more than 50% in the last couple of years, almost, you know, closing in on 70-80% increase in steel prices. This leads to increased building prices, and these new logistics facilities are built as new buildings. Therefore, their yields are very, very tight, meaning that the capital deployed doesn't get much of an additional return based on what people are actually willing to pay, because, you know, there's actually a company operating who has to pay that rental at the end of the day. So where are you seeing the big returns? Well, this might be contrarian, but office. I think office is one of the best investment sectors at the moment. And you look at Redefine, for example, a large component of its portfolio is office.
Office is the place to be. What a view. We'll leave it at that, John. Thanks so much for the time and for the insights. John Jack, CEO of Galetti Corporate Real Estate, on the real estate investment trusts in South Africa and where the opportunity sits. It's gone 7 o'clock. Greg Coase is standing by with the latest in evening news, followed by Michael Abramson and the top sport team. From my side, good night.